Moscow displaying the no-entry sign to almost 1,000 prominent Americans, including President Biden, reciprocating similar moves by Washington. Australia's incoming Prime Minister pledges fresh relations with the world following elections that ended Conservative rule after almost a decade. And public transport partially reopens in Shanghai, China's largest city's moving to ease COVID restrictions. It's good to have you with us. The top story this hour, Russia blacklisting some 960 U.S. citizens in response to Western sanctions. Leading Americans on the foreign ministry's list include President Joe Biden, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Hollywood actor Morgan Freeman. The individuals are banned from entry to Russia indefinitely. The foreign ministry says that the sanctions are necessary to counter the U.S. attempts to establish, quote, a neo-colonial world order on the rest of the planet. Moscow has already blacklisted the State Secretary Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin. Russia, however, says it remains open to honest dialogue and that it draws a line between the American people and authorities inciting Russophobia. The Ukrainian president believes that there is only one way to resolve the conflict with Russia. That's diplomacy. Volodymyr Zelensky says that Ukraine did not start the conflict, but it has to finish it. According to the official, even though Ukraine can be victorious on the battlefield, a breakthrough will only be reached at the negotiating table. Meantime, an aide to Zelensky says that there is no way Ukraine would agree to a ceasefire or accept any deal with Moscow that involves surrendering territory. Mykhailo Podolyak, who is also Ukraine's lead negotiator, says that making concessions would backfire, and that's because Russia would hit back harder after any break in fighting. Currently, negotiations are deadlocked, with both sides accusing each other of stalling the process. In an exclusive report, our correspondent in Ukraine, John Miller, investigates the alleged single most deadly war crime of the conflict so far.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike. This man worked at the theater.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in. It's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder.
At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement. But told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theater at a field kitchen. None survived, they said.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theater. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
Behind me is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
Again, I'm moving on. Australia making a transition from a conservative rule to a Labour government, with the incoming Prime Minister pledging fresh relations with the world and a transform of climate policies. Anthony Albanese says that he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. The Labour leader has called his upcoming summit with the Japanese, Indian, U.S. leaders an absolute priority. Climate is expected to be at the heart of those talks. Albanese and his government are expected to be sworn in Monday after Labour winning a parliamentary majority in general elections. He may still need a coalition partner to rule, but he has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of conservative rule in Australia, which is now associated with climate disasters such as burning forests and smog-enveloped cities. China's largest city of Shanghai is gradually emerging from a COVID lockdown in the wake of slowing infections. Four of the city's 20 subway lines will now restart, along with some road transport, and this will form a basic network covering all central urban areas. Those who take public transport will have to show a negative COVID test within 48 hours and have a normal temperature. Some factories have also resumed operations, and residents in lower-risk areas are being allowed to venture outdoors. The city of 25 million residents reported more than 600 COVID cases on Sunday, almost all of them asymptomatic. Shanghai entered a strict lockdown at the end of March to combat a rising number of Omicron cases, in line with the country's zero COVID policy. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that there will be no let-up in Palestinians' resistance against the Tel Aviv regime. Hamas's political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh made a comment in a televised speech on the anniversary of a retaliatory Palestinian operation called Al-Quds Sword. He said the operation targeted the Israeli regime's security. He added that the operation was not limited to specific geographical territory, but was a strategic battle whose ramifications spilled over across the world. He also warned Tel Aviv against desecrating the Al-Aqsa Mosque, adding that Palestinians will not tolerate any such sacrilegious move. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for a 17-year-old killed by Israeli forces. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes. The victim, identified as Amjad Al-Fayed, was shot dead during a raid on a Jenin refugee camp. Another teenager was also critically wounded. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shatai has condemned Fayed's killing, stressing that the international community should hold Israel accountable for its acts. The incident happened days after the Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied territories. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says that most victims of the Israeli attacks in the occupied West Bank in recent months have been teenagers.
Since the beginning of this year, 20 Palestinians were killed only in Jenin. Some four of them are under the age of 18. This Palestinian who was shot dead this morning, Amjad Al-Fayed, he's only 17 years old, and even less than this. His friend, 18 years old, was seriously wounded during this Israeli military operation to Jenin. We can say that many of the Palestinian youths and Palestinian young men continue to be engaged in the different forms of resistance. And maybe in the last few months, we are witnessing more Palestinians are holding arms, trying to prevent the fully armed Israeli soldiers with their armored vehicles and tanks from raiding Jenin refugee camp. According to witnesses and according to Palestinian paramedics in the Jenin refugee camp, Amjad Fayed was shot by almost a dozen rounds in his upper part.
Okay, we got a couple of reports from the UK. The first one, the British Home Secretary Priti Patel has branded the anti-Israel boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. Now, that comment was made during a recent speech at a pro-Israel lobby group meeting where she additionally reaffirmed her loyalty in defending Israel. Robert Carter has a report.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper structuralized racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
A new list released by British daily The Sunday Times says that there are a record number of billionaires in the UK, with the richest 250 people worth more than £500 billion. Released in the middle of a soaring cost of living crisis, this year's list has new entrants, among them a UK government minister and his wife.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily The Sunday Times Rich List. In this country, it says 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working, and obviously we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years. While the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the you know, the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, we, you know, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out, suddenly, out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men. At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices, and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Poor is up, London.
Well, that's all we had for you in this news hour.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
temperature.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
Yeah, all clear there and left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, no nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward and the worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt. And it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath though.
Yeah, well, me too.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze, well, you've got it all over you. You're wet through some bloody days.
What, just cover them and stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean one.
Oh, right, OK.
About there? Yeah.
And you can
Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole and they crunched them up with a dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on. Digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums? The
drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to snip around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 2,4,5-T, which was thought to be more toxic than 2,4-D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 245T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
Kills the entire weed, roots and all.
What many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is the sample.
Right.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 245T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gall sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 24D. Tests on one 24D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 24D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case. The industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 24D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 24D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
24D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 24D.
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I would have to... I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine just outside of Melbourne and sent it to government laboratories for testing. The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos 625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked.
It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost seven times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing.
Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides, and that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and them not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas. And it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products.
What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further, so they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he's constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
The cos leather's growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There's no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking out from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field, at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals, and the environment. It's yet to finish that review.
Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995, but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
¶¶ some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believed this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles.
stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Life is complicated. I don't think this fact is hidden or doubted by anyone that life is pretty darn complicated, mostly because of other people. We have trouble understanding other people. We can't read one another's minds. We all come from different backgrounds and cultures, and it's hard for us to be able to read each other, and it's hard for us to read ourselves, really, to be honest. And then determining what our destination and purpose is, and what's our objective and goal, and what are we doing here, and trying to find meaning in all this, all of that just adds to the complication and difficultness of life. One of the elements which is of the utmost importance in helping us overcome these hardships and difficulties is, ironically enough, a good companion, being in the company of another person. What do I mean by that? Why is it so important? What are its effects and impacts on our lives? What are the dimensions of this relationship? All of that and much more in this short, cute little anecdote we will listen to together, and we're going to be right back to the point I'm trying to make. Stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear friends, we have a nice story for this part. Thank you very much for listening to Lantern. The two pots. Two pots, one of the brass and the other of clay, stood together on the hearthstone. One day the brass pot proposed to the earthen pot that they go out into the world together, but the earthen pot excused himself, saying that it would be wiser for him to stay in the corner by the fire. "It would take so little to break me," he said. "You know how fragile I am. The least shock is sure to shatter me." "Don't let that keep you at home," urged the brass pot. "I shall take very good care of you. If you should happen to meet anything hard, I will step between and save you." So the earthen pot at last consented, and the two set out side by side, jolting along on three stubby legs, first to this side, then to that, and bumping into each other at every step. The earthen pot could not survive that sort of companionship very long. They had not gone 10 paces before the earthen pot cracked, and at the next jolt he flew into 1,000 pieces. Equals make the best friends.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at a story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
I don't want to constantly fall back on that clay pot, brass pot anecdote, because it's just a story. So let's refer ourselves more to the holy verses of the Quran. Prophet Khidr alayhi salam was a man, a wise man of infinite knowledge in his time, and he knew, you know, about all the ropes of life, and he was the great wise one in this story. And his state was very different from Prophet Musa for whatever the reason. And he makes it clear from the very beginning that look, you can't possibly bear this journey with me. You won't be able to tolerate it. And Prophet Musa, he accepted the challenge. And I think it was brave of him. He accepted the challenge. And everything that Khidr did after that was questionable for him. And in every case, he was like, dude, what's your deal? And at the end, Prophet Khidr elaborates for him and explains, this is the difference between them, right? The difference in their levels. But then again, the common ground that they have was that, well, first of all, they were both sort of appointed by God. And I say sort of because some people debate whether Prophet Khidr was like a Rasul. And that's, again, another different story. First of all, they were both appointed by God. They were both on a mission, on a holy, sacred mission. They both had the same objectives and goals in life, which was the satisfaction of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Prophet Musa embarked on this journey to gain Allah's satisfaction. And Khidr did whatever he did through the story because he was ordered by God to do it, you know, throughout the knowledge that he had received from Allah. The other commonality between them was that they were both refined characters, right? Neither of them was a tyrant. Neither of them was a bully. Neither of them did whatever they did whimsically, you know, out of personal desire or for personal gain. They were both pious and righteous. And all of these common things contributed to their growth, even though they were at different levels. So that basically the moral of the story here, what I'm trying to say is that life is hella hard. It's hella complicated. And it's going to be hard either way, right? Whether we isolate ourselves or we don't. And both sides have got pros and cons, obviously. No one knows this better than an introvert. But the pros of finding a good friend, a good companion that can aid, support, protect, teach us through this journey, can call us out for our mistakes, can encourage us when we're doing something good, someone who is happy when we're happy and whom we can give good news to and whom we can share bad news with without necessarily being lectured and judged and condemned. Someone that has all the qualities that our narrations describe a good friend should have, like being like a mirror that reflects all our good qualities and helps us reevaluate ourselves. A person who protects us in our absence and stands up for us, doesn't talk behind our back. Someone that we can rely on in times of need. Someone who constantly reminds us of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These qualities really shouldn't be taken lightly. And if we find a companion in life that has these qualities, we should grab hold to them and like not let go. Not to an extent where it's like borderline stalking, but develop a nice, a good, sound, firm, sacred bond between one another and help each other grow. Maybe then we won't be so sad and depressed. Now to find someone that manifests the love of God, someone who's God-sent, if you may. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.